professor at MIT, and works at the Computer Science and AI Lab, which used to be called the AI Lab, at least the half of it that you would have been in.
Sorry.
And so I was just talking to Russ, and you know, we have a lot of connections. So Russ worked for Dan Kotecheck a long time ago, and hung around at the Leg Lab. Leg Lab, MIT Leg Lab, as you know, is a successor to the CMU Leg Lab. And you know, I used to hang around the CMU Leg Lab. I'm wondering how many people here were associated in some way with the Leg Lab.
That's a lot.
So it's quite a legacy, and somebody else there. And what else was I going to say? Another interesting bit is the connection with the cognitive sciences at MIT, which used to be called the psychology department, which is something you shared with Mark Raber and who else? And Chris, of course, that's right. A lot of connections here. Russ has done some interesting work, I'm sure many of you already know about, in passive dynamic walking and learning. And is leading one of the competing projects with Little Dog. And are you going to tell us all your secrets, how Little Dog works?
Yeah, it stays until about an hour 20.
And I'll just mention that after this, there is a post-seminar reception. So you might find yourself over that direction later on. Anyway, please join me in welcoming Russ Stetter.
So, I want to convince you today that learning, reinforcement learning in particular, works. Some interesting dynamical tasks, and I want to specifically focus in on biped locomotion and a pretty different thing, but fixed-wing acrobatics. So, if I start talking about biped locomotion, I'm obliged to start with Asimov, which is, by all accounts, still a state-of-the-art in walking. You've probably all seen this, but things to point out, Asimov clearly capable walker on the flat terrain. You'll notice if you watch carefully that it's always got 1 foot flat on the ground. In that domain though, it can climb stairs, it can kick soccer balls, you can entertain crowds. So if we look more seriously at how well it works, it works well on flat terrain, no question. It works on stairs. And very impressive, but the trajectories it executes are constrained by an overly restrictive measure of dynamic balance. I'll tell you exactly what I mean by that. For that simplification that the control system uses, they pay a huge price. You cannot compete, as well cannot compete, at least today, with humans in terms of speed, efficiency, or robustness, any of the metrics I might care about. So 0.83 meters per second, top speed, that's their running gait, the new numbers, but maybe not quite the fair comparison. You know, the Olympics and sprinters are averaging 10 meters per second. And whereas you and I are certainly faster than 0.83 meters per second. You can measure the efficiency of human walking by measuring the volume of oxygen consumed. If you do the proper scalings and compare that to how much energy, how much current and is coming out of the batteries of Asimov's using something like 20 times as much energy as a human. And there's really no examples because of this flat foot walking. No examples of Asimov walking on uneven or unmodeled terrain. So what's the problem? What's so hard about walking? And in a single word, it's that walking is underactuated. That's the problem. What do I mean by underactuated system? So the classical canonical underactuated system is, imagine you have an acrobat, a two-link robotic arm, where someone who forgot to put a motor at the shoulder, but they were kind enough to give you a motor at the elbow. Okay, so if you wanted to do something interesting with this robotic arm, then we have to be a little bit more clever. You can't just do some PD control solution to servo yourself to the top. You have to start reasoning about the nonlinear dynamic coupling between the motions at the second joint and the motions at the first joint. In fact, you can use the torque at the elbow to control the accelerations at the shoulder, but you just have to reason about those dynamics. And certainly people have done interesting things with the acrobat. This is a standard example of acrobat swing-up. So swings up and stably balances at the top. Actually, that's one of the audio things I forgot. My speakers don't work, and I told them when I plugged it in I was going to add some weird sound. So this is a stable fixed point. You can actually you can apply an LQR, linear quadratic controller, as well. You can go shove this thing in either direction. It'll stabilize in both degrees. Okay, so walking is underactive. Consider a cartoon of a seven-link planar bipod. You've got seven links you want to control, and if you put an actuator at every joint, you've got six actuators to do it. If you just play the counting game, underactuated, more formally, is that you cannot produce an arbitrary acceleration at an arbitrary instant of time. That's always the case if your system has less actuators than degrees of freedom. That's the trivial case of underactuated. So in walking, you want to, in this example, you want to control 7 degrees of freedom. If you want to control the entire robot, probably you want to control its speed and everything like that. But you're missing the motor that you might want the most, which is the motor that connects you to the ground. That's the motors that robotic arms have that walking robots don't have. Okay, so you can kind of get around that. If you're willing to assume that the foot is bolted to the ground, then you can think of yourself as a walking robotic arm, and you can sort of pretend that you're fully actuated. That's the way I think about the Honda approach and the ZMG walking approach. So if you constrain the dynamics, if you keep your foot flat on the ground, you can pretend that you're fully actuated, but you have to constantly estimate the danger of foot roll with ground reaction forces by measuring it with force load sensors in the feet. You have to carefully design your trajectories to avoid any dynamic regimes which might tip the foot. You can play the kinematics game where you have to keep your knees bent to avoid singularities, and then if you're willing to do all that, then you can pretty much get away and make things walk with high gain PD control. Okay. And that's the approach used, from 10,000 feet, that's the approach used by a number of these ZMT walkers. There's a different approach out there. This is almost not a robot at all. You probably have seen these passive dynamic walkers. It's a system of links and ball bearings, no motor, no controller, no external power, put it on top of a small ramp, give it a push, and look what it can do. So this is built by Steve Collins and Andy Levine at Cornell. And this is the other one. And so by most accounts, most people would agree that that looks more natural than ASMO. You don't care about how natural. Certainly it's more energy efficient than ASMO. It's powered only by gravity. It's restricted to walking down a ramp. We'll get back to that. But really, the important message in these passive dynamic walkers is that they really demonstrate that high gain feedback control is not a necessary approach to walking. In fact, if you're willing to let the dynamics of your machine do some of the work for you, there's very beautiful, natural, nonlinear dynamics which you can exploit. So the challenge is, you've got these passive walkers. They work downhill. They're great. They are sensitive. The Collins walker, by his own words, has to be initialized by a skilled hand. You know, it works. You push it just right, sensitive to initial conditions. So the big question is, let's say we want to add an actuator or two. I don't care how many actuators you add, but I just want to take this system, which is already doing beautiful, natural, dynamical things, almost the right thing, and I just want to push it and pull it a little bit to make it more useful. Make it walk on flat terrain, over rocks. How do you do it? One approach to underactuated control is optimal control. So in optimal control, this is the computer scientists taking a control problem and turning it into an optimization problem. Right? If you're willing to formulate the goal of control as a long-term optimization of a scalar cost, the long-term is really essential. That's the piece that allows your computational machinery to reason about long-term nonlinear dynamics, long-term consequences of your control actions, which is essential in underactuated systems. If you're willing to write the things down as a control problem, then you can, and people have done for many years, taken systems like the Acrobat, popped it into a computational optimization algorithm, and that works. You can get beautiful trajectories which right to the top on the Acrobat. Okay, so how far can you get with that? Machine learning, as I mentioned today, reinforcement learning, is basically trying to do exactly that problem that we can do, that people have done for many years, on real data coming from the real robot. That's my view of reinforcement learning. So it's just an online statistical control solution, which is trying to do the exact same thing as our optimization online. the simulation. If you do it right, then in the best cases, you can get machines to learn how to walk, learn how to solve the optimal control problem without any simulations whatsoever. And sometimes in as little, this one worked in as little as 20 minutes. So this is a little passive dynamic walker. It's a when its motors are turned off and its computers are turned off right now, it's actually, it's walking down, this is a passive gate, it's simulating a passive gate, the motors are locked. And this is just showing off that it is an effective passive dynamic walker. But this one, unlike its predecessors, has motors in series with the ankle, if you've got the new control joint. So it has the ability to add a little bit of energy and push off the ground and stabilize itself on platforming. These are the initial videos. I always like to show the very first videos where we're still afraid that it's going to do something crazy, so there's pads on. But in just a few minutes of trial and error learning, it learned how to stabilize a basic limit cycle. We started asking it to walk around. And in about 10 minutes, normally 20 minutes is our safety margin, we got to learn how to walk. And surprisingly robust. I'll tell you a few more details about it. But first, I want to back up just a little bit and tell you about the dynamics of walking. Okay? The best way to get your head around the dynamics of walking is to think of a rimless wheel. Okay, so this is McGeer's way to think about, Ted McGeer started the passive walking, like to think about walking in terms of these rimless wheels. So take a wheel, take the rim off, now you've just got a bunch of massless spokes, we'll assume, and a point mass at the base, at the hub. Okay, if you assume that the point foot here doesn't slip, and you assume that the collisions as the leg comes around are instantaneous and inelastic, and that they cause an instantaneous change of support, so you've got instantly got a new pin joint, B, then you've got a system that's pretty analytically tractable. Okay? You've got a conservative, you know, no energy losses, simple pendulum during the stance phase, and you've got a dissipative impact defined by the switching surface when the foot comes into the ground. And what it looks like, surprisingly maybe, that system, even though it's passive during the first part of the movie here, if you take that system, put it on top of a small ramp, then something surprising happens. So it started off with a fairly large angular velocity, and it slowed down to a constant stable limit cycle. So it's actually formally a stable process. It, the collisions with the terrain take out a little bit of energy, but gravity adds a little bit of energy back. These things at steady state automatically balance. But the surprising thing is when it's rolling too fast, the collision takes out a little bit more energy. When it's rolling too slow, it actually takes out less energy and speeds up. So this thing formally, and we can show that it goes to a rolling fixed point from a very large range of initial conditions. Okay, the analysis of the rimless wheel is a limit cycle analysis. And it uses this idea of return maps. So let me just say the return map story real quickly. This is some oscillating system, right? This is a Van der Pol oscillator plotted in state space, right? So it has some state space trajectory that goes like this. How do I talk about the stability of a limit cycle? Well, it's a hard problem, actually. We still don't have very good methods for it, right? Because the stability of a limit cycle is much more difficult than the stability of a trajectory. If I'm on this point on the limit cycle and I get perturbed here, then I want to, if I still go on the limit cycle but don't actually collapse my phase, then I still like to think of that as a stable limit cycle. So comparing a time-based trajectory doesn't quite work. Turns out we don't have very good tools. The way we do it is we draw a surface of section and do a Poincaré map or a return map. So we look at the system every time it crosses that section and we make a plot on this return map. So in the Van der Pol oscillator, I'm looking at x dot every time it crosses this this plane, and for every pair of points, I can make one plot on my return map, which says the x dot at the nth crossing versus x dot at the n plus one crossing. Okay. If I take the Van der Pol oscillator, I run it from a lot of initial conditions, then I can plot out a return map over this domain, and just from this graphical analysis, I can say almost everything I want to say about the Van der Pol oscillator. Okay, I drew this a special line, the slope one in there, because if I have a point on that line, that means that's a fixed point of the return map. Right? I came in with one velocity, I came out with exactly the same velocity. If I'm above that line, that means I'm going to be speeding up. If I'm below that line, I'm going to be slowing down. So just looking at this, I can quickly say that this is a globally stable fixed point, actually. We with, except for a set of measure zero, there's a point, right? There's another fixed point without a zero. For this ramification of the manual velocity. Okay, so you can also define local stability by linearizing around the fixed point. All of your standard tricks work. The point is the return map analysis allows you to take this limit cycle dynamics and turn it into a problem of fixed point dynamics. Okay. So here's what the return map looks like for a rimless wheel. Okay, in some angle, well, some slope, some parameters. The blue line is the return map. I actually use the same colors. The dashed line is my line of slope 1 now. In fact, there's this big region where if I'm going too fast, I slow down. There's this region here where if I'm going too slow, I speed up. And there's a fixed point, a rolling fixed point right here. There's another fixed point, of course, where the thing's just sitting there standing still. And there's one other really weird thing that can happen. You can end up in these dashed lines. Just think, what could those dashed lines possibly be? Those are the weird states where I find myself, I started with just the wrong initial velocity, angular velocity. This is the steps that match the angular velocity at the beginning of the stance to the end of the stance. I start with just the wrong angular velocity, then I'll go in balance at the top and never get back to my return map. Okay? So those things exist. They're dashed lines on our point array section. Okay, but we can carefully analyze this system. Coleman and Ruina analyzed it carefully, certainly. You can plot the basins of attraction of each of the fixed point analytically. This is the only walking system out there where we can say almost everything we want to say analytically. Okay. And in fact, the entire right plane here of this line is in the basin of attraction of that rolling fixed point. In the left, when you start with negative velocities, which is rolling uphill initially, it's more complicated. It turns out you can either end up rolling or standing. If you think about it, if you roll uphill, depending on where you stop, you might have enough energy to turn around and roll forward, or you might just end up standing still. Okay, so, and actually this is a nice, you notice they get bigger, it turns out that there's a contraction mapping analysis of this. We show that there's actually these two fixed points are globally, there's global convergence of one of these two fixed points, except for, again, the set of measure zero, where you end up balancing up top, and you have to worry about those. Okay, so that's a nice way to think about walking. We should have plots like this for Avenue. You know, we don't. But that's really the pure way to think about it. Okay, you can take that rimless wheel, you can make it more interesting, you can take away the extra legs, put a pin joint in the middle, then that becomes the compass gate walker. Again, the story is basically the same. You've got a swing leg dynamics to worry about, but the basic story is you've got a conservative system during stance, you have a dissipative impact, these things exactly balance in steady state and get stable walking out. And you make them more and more interesting models until you get back to these experimental machines that work surprisingly well. Okay, so let's set up the control problem. So these simple models predict stable walking on a ramp, but not flat. That's correct. Walking on a flat grade. So let's add at least one actuator to push and pull the passive dynamics. Okay, so I'll just write the equations of motion in this notation, pointing out that that for mechanical systems, the accelerations are linear in torques. And so I'll partition the equations of motion like that. And our goal here is to design a feedback law, which maps joint velocities and joint positions and joint velocities into some control torques. Saying the same thing again, it's difficult because the systems are underactuated. In this formulation, the underactuation presents itself as this matrix, system matrix F2 is low rank. So you can see that immediately, that implies that I cannot find an arbitrary U, I cannot produce arbitrary accelerations Q double dot through the control of U. So I cannot follow arbitrary trajectories, I can't do arbitrary trajectories. Okay, so how do we formulate optimal control for these walkers? The best thing you can hope for on this return map is a flat one, right? That's the deadbeat controller. That's the best I can hope for. If I start from any initial condition, if I've got a target point here, then in a single step, I'm going to be exactly at my fixed point. Okay, so that's exactly the cost function we use. Every time the robot takes a step, penalize it with the Euclidean distance from the point on the return map, from the optimal deadbeat controller. How do you find where the location for that optimal return map? Well, that's given for you, the passive walkers, you've seen an example of good walking down the slope. So you can take the desired limit cycle on the slope and use that as, on the return map as your target for walking the flat terrain. A learning approach is pretty simple to understand. It's a policy gradient approach. Basically, take that parameter, that feedback controller, make it as a linear combination of a non-linear basis functions. At the beginning of every step the robot takes, you make a small temporary random change to those parameters, just fiddling with the parameters. At the end of the footstep, you see how the robot walked. If it walked better than you expected, then you make a permanent change to W based on the results, right? So the way to think about that is that each test is estimating the policy gradient, right? The change in walking performance as a function of W. And then you're just trying to perform stochastic gradient descent. In practice, we put a lot of work into the exact statistical form of these updates to make it work well. I use the value function critic to reduce the variance of the update. There were a lot of statistical tricks that made it work quickly, but that's the central idea. All right, so on this robot I showed you, the hip joint is passive. There's actuators down at the ankle. The legs are stacked with sensors, tilt sensors, pitch and roll, rate gyros, hip potentiometers. The arms look like an additional complexity, but they're actually just mechanically linked to the opposite leg, right? So it reduces the yaw moment, makes them walk a little straighter. So if you count it up, it's clearly under-actuated. There's about 9 degrees of freedom if you say you're constrained to a point on the ground, and there's four actuators. And the way to visualize the success of learning is that if I take that robot, put it down on flat terrain, this is what the Poincaré map looks like. Now I'm plotting a section through the high-dimensional Poincaré map. This is just in the this dimension of the robot. Angular velocity at one step versus angular velocity at the next step. And what you'd expect is you lose energy on every step until you end up standing still. Okay, that's the default. It's a damped oscillator when it's unpowered on flat terrain. Okay, but the feedback control, just from these trial and error experiments on the real robot, was able to reshape that dynamics. Okay, so it started pushing and pulling the system in such a way that it reshaped that dynamics into this this broad basin of attraction on the Poincaré map. So from very small, in fact zero, it stabilizes up to the stable fixed point. This line was the desired fixed point based on looking at it walking down a hill. And it slows down if you're going too fast too. So this might not look very much like the flat line. The flat line is probably impossible. I can't say formally, but probably impossible because of actuator limits. But this is actually a surprisingly good map. If you count how many steps it takes to get to the fixed point, it's actually not many. You can get up there pretty quick. Then one or two steps to get right to your nominal fixed point. All right. So the learning. This was trying to be a demonstration of fast perspective learning. Okay, so the policy that the robot used to produce that was actually only a function of two state variables. The critic was only a function of one state variable. That's okay. It was a choice made to optimize the learning performance. But in the rest of the sense, it was actually fairly pure. I started with actually zero in my learning parameter. All my control parameters were zero because that was a special case where it acted like a passive walker. Never built a simulation of the system. All the trials were on the real robot. It began walking, meaning it got foot clearance after a minute, and converged every time in less than 20 minutes. A very interesting thing about I told you there's this variance reduction step based on the critic. In fact, if you reset the policy parameters but leave the critic, the value function estimate in place from the previous run, then actually it gets good performance in a few steps and converges in 1 or 2 minutes. So the critic made a big difference. And the nice thing about it is that it learns quickly enough to adapt to the trend as it walks. So literally, if you walk off one surface, walk onto another surface, you'd see if they got an awkward step or two, but in a few steps, it was off and went. It didn't just work because the robot was stable. It's tempting to think that it's just because it's stable. And the experiment we do to show that off is that you ask the system to stabilize on two steep over ramp. If you start with plain initial conditions, it falls over every time you pick it up. It's a more annoying experiment. But it worked just in the same time capsule, right? It said it still stabilized the robot and came up with the same return map. So I'm biased, but I think this is, I like to think that it stands out as an example of a real learning system that works fast in real time, and it's fast enough that it's interactive. You can go in and you can stick a mass on the side and you can watch it limp for a few minutes and it'll figure it out. It's solving a fairly simple problem, but it's really fast and effective learning. Okay, why did it work? It worked because the dynamics of the robot were right. There's statistical tricks that we played that were novel, but the major, big reason it worked is that the mechanical design was made. There was something about the mechanical design which made it a very convex, easily optimized problem. Okay, so what are the goals for these ultra-passive walkers? So Cornell also built a level ground walker. They showed off that their level ground walker has the efficiency comparable to human. Okay? There's lots of new work out there now on almost passive walkers. I think it's fair to say that the world believes these passive walkers are a good idea for level ground. But everybody I've talked to says that they're afraid, right? That they're sensitive to initial conditions, they only work on perfectly smooth surfaces. Perhaps it's because the field is too focused on steady state walking, and I think that they're in general overfitting, but because of all these things, I'm going to make it a priority now to work on passive walking and show that passive walking is a relevant idea for walking. Right? So here's a rimless wheel. So we took a step back. This is a high speed video of a rimless wheel. Okay. Turns out those plots I showed you, this return map plot, it's very rare to see return maps coming from real walking robots. Okay, because they're noisy, they're high dimensional, really hard to get it right. Turns out if you take the simplest of systems, a rimless wheel, and we spent some time building it, it's some arbitrary rimless wheel. If you watch the dynamics, very different than the model, right? I mean, these impacts, people have obviously spent their careers studying impact dynamics. The model, as it's, we're actually putting more compliance in than we should in the feet with these rubber soles on the feet. But the thing's slipping, it's sliding, it's bouncing, and the ramp, even though we did our best job to level it out, there's a slightly different slip, there's a little bow to the ramp. I actually think that one of the reasons that you don't see these return map plots when we build that is that basically all terrain is rough terrain. Actually, the tools we're using are impoverished in respect to real robots. Okay, so let's think quickly about extending those models to more interesting terrain. So what happens if you take this rimless wheel and now put it on stochastically rough terrain? So at each step, the terrain is drawn. The slope of the terrain is drawn from some distribution. Okay, I can't plot a return map analysis of that. Well, I could draw points on the return map, but it wouldn't make any sense. They'd be bouncing all over the place. I wouldn't see any fixed points. But the system's clearly doing something that resembles the limit cycle walking. I mean, certainly you can do the same thing with compass gates and heat walkers. The terrain that they can handle is a little less, but certainly they can handle rough terrain. So there's a real question here. How do we even define good walking when you're on rough terrain? Here's my proposal. If the terrain is rough, whether it's structured rough terrain or even stochastic rough terrain that you didn't model, the right way possibly to think about these dynamics are as stochastic processes on the return map. Okay. So technically, if I've got a stochastic system, I'm bouncing around. The picture you should have in your head is I'm executing this basic limit cycle, but I'm bouncing around. The world's bouncing me around a little bit, so I'm never exactly on my limit. Technically, there is no limit cycle in the system, but it's misleading to say that the system doesn't have any stability properties. Okay. Physicists have talked about this for a long time. The world they use is metastability. Here's the cartoon. Imagine a particle, a little red dot here, subject to Brownian motion. It wants to bounce around. And it lives on a potential. Okay. So what happens? You put this particle up in a potential well. It tends to come down and sit near the bottom, but it's always in motion. It's a little Brownian motion, so it's bouncing around. It clearly spends most of its time in this potential well. But depending on the form of your noise, if you have Gaussian noise, for instance, a typical Brownian motion, then this particle actually makes random escape attempts. And one of the statistics that people watch in these kind of systems is actually the number of escape attempts, the number of successful escape attempts, the distributions of times that the system lives in different basins of attraction. Okay, that's exactly the right. If you think of this now as the dynamics on a return map, then I think actually that's exactly the right picture for walking. So this is a zoom in on the return map for the rimless wheel. This is the deterministic rimless wheel. If I'm again pulling my terrain out of a distribution on every step, then really what happens is I get a stochastic return map, where on every step, if I come in with some angular velocity, I have a distribution. You know, in this color plot here, I have some distribution of landing in these different configurations on the output. Okay, so that's just a straightforward Markov process, and we can start understanding it. In particular, if you're willing to discretize the model as a Markov chain, we're going to make one special model, which is for general robots, is the robot falling down. In our model, it means the robot coming to a stop in the stop fixed point. And you start looking at the dynamics of this Markov chain, and you can see a lot of interesting things about the robot. Okay, let's do a quick eigenvalue analysis of the Markov chain. If you order the eigenvalues in decreasing, or in lambda 1 is the largest, and going down, and you label the corresponding eigenvectors as vi, and you define this characteristic time constant as 1 over log lambda, then here's what happens. The Markov chain dynamics tells you everything you want to know. First of all, there's an eigenvalue of 1. Okay? That corresponds to the stationary distribution of our random process. It's, in this case, since we have an absorbing state, it constitutes the entire state distribution being at the falling down state. It's a kind of a grim view of robotics, right? It says that my robot will fall down with probability 1 as time goes to infinity. But it's correct, I think. the interesting stuff is if you peel down one more layer, okay? Eigenvalue 2 is, in these systems, tends to be pretty close to 1. And eigenvalue 3 maybe be close to 1 too, but a lot of times you see that the characteristic time constant of eigenvalues 2 and 3 are very different. So what does that mean? That means, so these extra eigenvectors and eigenvalues represent the transient dynamics of the system as they go towards that stationary distribution. If you have a few that stand out, which go away much slower than the others, then that's when people start invoking the language of metastability. Okay, so I have some long-living transient distribution. It hangs around in my system for a long time, and compared to everything else in the system, it degrades much slower. Okay. So V2, the second eigenvector, which corresponds to this almost one eigenvalue, is what we call the metastable distribution. Okay, if you get into this this work, then there's a number of beautiful quantities that we quickly can compute about our walking machine. So for instance, if we have this Markov chain description of the walker, then I can tell you quickly with a straightforward calculation of computation the expected time that we should expect the robot to fall down, the mean first passage time to the fall down state. Right? There's all these quantities that just come out of that analysis that you really can compute. So if you look at the rimless wheel, then here's what happens, okay? If we look at the metastable distribution, the long-living distribution, this is what characterizes that the stability properties of the system beyond the falling down. Then, of course, it's dependent on the slope you're on, but you get some, this is the nominal fixed point of the system, and the system, the state of the system tends to hang around. With high probability, it hangs around this stationary fixed point. It's bouncing around. It's living in a neighborhood of the stable limit cycle in the deterministic world. But on every step, with some probability, it might wipe out and start standing still in the rimless wheel, or it might wipe out and fall down if it comes. And if you look at the, this is, I didn't say what sigma was. Sigma is the distribution. We're literally using Gaussian noise in the stochastic terrain. So as I increase the distribution, the variance of the noise, on if I increase the roughness of the terrain, then this distribution flattens out and starts taking more and more exotic excursions from the stable limit cycle of walking. But still, it's quantified nicely by these metastable basins of attraction. And in fact, if I keep turning up this, if I look at the mean first passage time, the expected time that the robot falls down, for very small sigmas, it's all relative, then the system basically goes forever. It's in the vicinity of the rolling fixed point. Within numerical precision, that red line is sort of numerical precision. It's basically going to run forever. And then it degrades slowly, the mean first passage time, but predictably, based on the amount of noise, the roughness of the terrain. Okay, so that's a nice, I think that's a formalism that might help us break this lock on steady state walking and start talking about walking on rough terrain, at least statistically rough terrain. And it also is a little incentive for the control. So now, since we talk about that being noise, but if we're talking about a stochastic process, then really the right thing we want to optimize is the mean perception. I want to call down as late as possible. Okay, so we have a new goal for control, and we're building this is a dynamic evaluation solution to a compass game robot with a actuator, a torque actuator at the hip and an impulsive actuator at the toe, walking on pretty surprisingly rough terrain, optimizing its first passage time. Okay, so point is, this is a one-link robot. This is an approximation, but this is a one-link robot two-link robot that's walking over more terrain, certainly than Asimo ever has. And actually, I think it'd be pretty impressive to see this little robot, which we can, because it's simple enough, we can solve the brute force optimal control problem, and actually see this guy walking on really rough terrain. So that's, we're building it now. And we're using Little Dog's terrain as a enabler and the motion capture, of course. And we're trying to build passive walkers that walk on this rough terrain. Okay, so coming soon. All right, so that's sort of a different approach to robots, maybe. This is my approach to ever-robots. In general, I think you should accept that interesting systems in the world are under-actuated. Relinquish control. Let go of your robots. Formulating control is an optimization problem, a long-term optimization, because that's one of the only tools we've got to think about these long-term dynamics. You've got to use, I'm not suggesting by any means that we throw out classical control. You have to use all the classical control and potentially unconventional mechanical design, everything you've got in your toolbox, you need to throw out the problem to simplify things. But then maybe there's a chance that learning is going to start working for you. And you should expect extraordinary performance on average, but it's going to fail every once in a while. This is sort of the optimal control versus robust control. I would like to maximize expected performance, not worst case performance. So I would like to think the robots are going to do spectacular things, but then I know they're going to wipe out every once in a well beyond wrong. So I want to show at least one more pretty different domain, and that's fixed-wing acrobatics. Okay, so conventional aircraft, I hope you see the analogies here. So conventional aircraft use high-gain feedback and avoid complicated nonlinear dynamic routines, just like the walkers out there. Okay? The higher performance and maneuverability, kind of in terms of maneuverability and efficiency, comes if you're willing to exploit the nonlinear unsteady fluid dynamic system. It's a different dynamical system, but it's just like walking, right? If you're willing to go into that nonlinear regime, you can do better, okay? So as a benchmark problem to try to make that point, let's think about the problem of taking a little plane, foam glider in this case, and trying to make it land on a perch. Okay, and I don't mean land on a perch like fly around, slowly take out the energy. I mean, we're gonna fire this thing at the perch, and it's gotta come to stop right there. Okay, why is that an interesting problem? Well, it's an interesting problem because fluid dynamics is hard. Okay? So if your wing, fluid dynamics 101 here is that if you have a simple airfoil, if you have it at a low angle of attack with respect to the oncoming flow, then the airflow around the wing is pretty simple. It's everything stays attached to the wing. If you have a control surface at the back of the wing, then actually linear bottles work fairly well. Linear control works quite well. As you go up to a higher angle of attack, you'll get more lift, but you still get this nice attached flow, things that you can reason about with conventional control and dynamics. Something dramatic happens when you cross the stall angle, right? The airflow separates from the back of the wing. There's a critical angle of attack here where you get separation. Okay, at that point, everything changes. Instead of having this nice laminar flow, you get a potentially turbulence, certainly in pockets of unsteady fluid dynamics, you get vortex shape. So the flow isn't constant with time. The effects of the flow are time varying, right? And they're certainly very nonlinear. And suddenly, you have less air going across your control surfaces, so the control problem gets dramatically harder. Okay, when you get into this regime, the dynamics just get too complicated for control design. That's sort of where we're at. There's a lack of compact design accessible models. I can run Navier-Stokes simulations, computational fluid dynamics simulations on this, and I can get good predictions, but it takes a long time on parallel machines, right? It's not, I can't run it 100,000 times and try to optimize some system around it. Okay. And the system's going to experience intermittent losses of control authority because it's going to stall its control surfaces. That's the underactuated control problem. That means the control actions have long-term consequences. Okay, but that regime on the right is the key to high-performance aerial vehicles, I think. Why do I think that? Well, birds do it. Is that argument enough? And planes don't do it. Here's how I try to convince you that planes don't do it. So it seems like if any planes were going to do it, if anybody wanted to stop quickly, it's the guys that are landing their F-14s up here. The way these guys land on a carrier is crazy. Right? They, first of all, the carrier has to be going 60 knots, 65 knots, something like that. They come down actually at a fairly low angle of attack, 8.1 degree angle of attack for F-14. Okay, you see that hook on the back, right? The hook, they've got four chances. There's four cables along the deck, right? That hook has to catch one of those four cables. If it bounces, if they come down quite right, they call it a bolter, and they have to hit the throttle full, otherwise they're going to go off the back of the carrier, plunk, into the ocean. Okay, so that's a scary business. And of course, if you were coming too low, that would be bad. right, so the angle of attack on even our most advanced control system, talk about highly advanced, a lot of money gone into optimizing control systems for these fighter jets. They stick in a low angle of attack regime between 0 and 15 degrees. 15 degrees is probably too much for an F-14. In those regimes, the airflow stays attached, the control surfaces maintain control authority, and they can use linear control. Very advanced linear control, but linear control. Sometimes there's nonlinear control to cancel out the nonlinear rigid body dynamics of the plane, but not nonlinear control to take care of the nonlinear dynamics of the fluid. Okay, so, and in fact, if you look at advanced fighter jet control systems, they have these departure modes. So they actually, if they do go into one of these stall modes, then it goes into it's called a departure, and it goes into open loop, evasive maneuver, trying to get back into the linear attack. They call it falling leaf departure because your plane can literally go whoop, whoop. You don't want that. But apparently, if you nose down, turn around, and do just the right thing, then it'll actually get you right back into the landing gear, as long as you're far enough off the ground. Okay, completely different story. Look at the birds. Okay, so this is a cardinal landing on a perch. He's fanned out like this, incredibly high angle of attack. He's coming down. It's probably 90 degrees or more angle of attack. It's hard to see, but there's a smoke trail in this picture where you can see that the airflow is spinning around. Okay. Why did you do that? Well, there's a huge advantage to doing it. First of all, if you're willing to fan out, then you get a lot more viscous drag. Right? So you just stick your hand out of the car, you're going to get a lot more drag. You get more surface area. But more subtly, if you get that pocket of air behind you, because your airflow is separated, then you get pressure drag. You get a pocket of low pressure behind the wing, and it actually acts like an air brake and slows you down. Okay? So it's a good thing to do if you're willing to reason about the nonlinear dynamics. People are trying perching. So this is there's a Cornell project where they're trying to develop a morphing plane, which can morph the body up to get this high angle of attack behavior, but they warp the wings down to keep them in a nice attached regime, and they move the tail out of the wing of the body so it has a nice attached airflow, and then they can do their linear control, but still get some of the benefits. I haven't seen that working yet. I've only seen these models in the approach is published. There's a good friend and collaborator at MIT is doing perching with foam planes too. This is the sort of the helicopter solution, right? And it's actually, and this is deceptively easy to do. You can just take a PD controller and put it on there, and it'll go from amazing. We did it in our lab too. From amazing range of initial conditions, you can make this thing hang on its propeller. The reason it works is because you have an enormous thrust to weight ratio, right? It's not just you're holding yourself up, but it's actually you're relying on the back draft from your propeller. I mean, your control surfaces need control authority, they need air to go be going over. So you're actually relying on the backflow from the propeller to keep your control surfaces from stalling. Okay, if you're willing to do that, build an airplane with a 10-to-1 thrust to weight ratio, and go like this and very slowly go to the perch, then you can perch like that. But both of those approaches sacrifice performance to make linear control work, right? So that's sort of, maybe it's the ASIMO approach. So I'm trying to say we can do nonlinear control on existing vehicles. And actually there's an interesting project you might have seen in the news by the AFRL. It's called Powerline Urban Century. right? So they want to land a UAV on a power line and absorb energy and recharge and go. Maybe they cut the power line and go. Their approach right now is that they said, this stuff doesn't work. We're just going to hit the perch at 45 miles an hour and make sure our plane can withstand the impact. That hurts. So there's something better you can do, okay? There's a machine learning approach, right? So why is it a good problem for learning? Well, the Navier-Stokes simulations, the CFD, can take days to compute. You can get very accurate simulations, but they take a really long time to compute. Machine learning makes it possible to efficiently model and reason about the unsteady dynamics and long-term consequences of control. That's what I've been saying all day. So the key idea, let's do approximate optimal control. So let's learn the model of the unsteady dynamics from real flight data. Do the long-term optimization of a scalar cost. Offline, where I did on Toddler, I never did offline numerical optimal control, but here, you know, it hurts a lot more when the plane crashes than when the walking robot crashes. So we're doing a lot of evaluation on the side, and then a touch of online learning on the real plane to capture any differences. All right, we've got this motion, just like you guys did. We've got this motion capture setup, which makes life good. But to make the point that we're not going to do any overpowered 10-to-1 thrust rate to weight ratio, I took the propeller right off, right? So we're talking about gliders, not overpowered machines. We're doing off-board sensing and control. And there's one more trick. The plane's got dihedral, so the wings are tilted up. That stabilizes the plane passively and roll. You can think about it. The center of pressure is going to be above the center of mass, so it just makes it passively stable and roll. It's also passively stable in yaw because it's got a nice big tail, so it has this weathercock stability. And the only problem, basically, this is it'd be a lousy plane to take from here to Boston, but it's a pretty good plane for landing on Earth because it just flies straight, and we only have to worry about controlling that dimension. Okay, so we shot the plane a bunch of times with just a hand design control policy, which made it go whoop, up into the side. Got a lot of flight data. You wrote the planes. very high angle of attack data. So you don't normally see real flight data up in this huge high angle of attack degrees regime. You just don't see that. Probably because you don't fire F-14s and let them fall out of the sky. but if you're willing to get that and you're willing to look at the data from motion capture, it's actually really clean data. Okay, it's surprisingly good match to theory. This is actually flat plate theory, is what you predict. But the theoreticians predict what happened, and we're getting it almost exactly from motion capture. But it's a little bit more than that. Actually, if you watch the drag coefficient over time as our system is perching, you can actually see the drag coefficient. Drag forces are oscillating at about 10 hertz. So when we're up in our perching maneuver, we can actually see that we're shedding vortices off the back of our plane at about 10 hertz. We're seeing all that from motion capture, differentiated and filtered, which we had got good at from the little bug. Okay, drag coefficient's not quite as clean, partially because of that oscillation, which is hidden in that data, but it matches theory pretty well. And using tried and true system identification methods from planes, we can build a model which uses some domain assumptions but generalizes well outside of, this is a barycentric mesh, but it's parameterized in such a way that it generalizes well outside the data. Got a very high fidelity model of the lift and drag forces. Built a nonlinear rigid body model of the vehicle. Got a lot of delay in the system. Motion capture is always bad, but we're doing over the radio link and everything like that. We've got a significant amount of delay. We modeled that all in actuator delay. Pop it into an optimal control problem. Here, the optimal control is to try to get as close as possible. So there's a min. It's not quite a normal optimal control. There's a min. This says over the entire. Take a look at the entire infinite horizon trajectory. Take the point that's closest to the perch, and score it as the quadratic cost. It's not the normal additive form of the Bellman equation, but you can still do a recursive update. Do a value iteration algorithm by discretizing the mesh over the state space. And here we go. Okay. So we're going to fire our plane into motion capture at 6 meters per second. There's a little string, just a little, you know, piece of twine across the lab, but it's registered in motion capture, 3.5 meters away from the entry into motion capture. And we're going to take only a second. We've limited the entire trajectory to a second just to rule out any trivial solutions. claim is, with those specifications, the only way to land on that perch is to go into this really, to do that trick I said, which is to stall your wings and exploit the pressure drag. There you go. It's filmed at 330 frames per second, slowed down. Really high angle of attack, 100 degrees when it starts coming down here. Shedding vortices, and we're still landing on our perch. Okay, so learning, I think learning's got a lot of potential, especially there's a lot of fairly low-dimensional problems that are just fantastically interesting, where learning can almost work today. Scaling's a major issue. Let me tell you one quick idea on scaling, and then I'll finish up. So motion planning, when I say learning, I'm a learning guy, I really mean I'm happy to do motion planning too. Motion planning right now is going to scale to higher-dimensional problems than optimal control solutions. Under-actuated systems, motion planning for under-actuated systems are sort of the hard one, the notoriously hard ones. You tend to have these tunnels and tubes and everything you don't want for an RRT or for a motion planner. So here's a quick trick. And it's the trick I think is going to pay off for learning too, but we've only got it working for motion planning so far. But there's the equations of motion of our robotic manipulators and all our walking robots have a common form, the well-studied manipulator equations. Okay? There's lots of structure in those governing equations. Okay, for instance, H is uniformly positive definite over the entire state space. There's lots of structure you can pull out and exploit there. So here's an idea. Let's take and make a high-dimensional under-actuated system act like a low-dimensional fully actuated system. Okay. Got this mapping designed by studying the equations of motion, which either produces the correct torques, it's a partial lead ag linearization, which either produces the correct torques or says, I can't do that. And then you just do a low-dimensional search. Okay, so here's a, to show that off to some extent, let's think about the swing-up problem for a five-link pendulum. This is actually only got a single passive joint right now. We can make this five, there's an algorithm we can write down by hand which makes this five-link pendulum act like this simple pendulum that you see in the cartoon behind there, where all it's trying to do is apply a torque at the base and a force prismatically. If we do our search in the low-dimensional space, apply this mapping and get back to the high-dimensional space, then we can, independent of the number of links in our big system, do motion planning for these really high-dimensional systems. Okay, and that's actually the way we're doing this little dog jump. It's a little bit of a secret sauce, as you might say. So for little dog...
Take this down, guys.
So for little dog, we think of trying to control the center of mass around a passive joint at the base by controlling the torque, applying an artificial torque around this passive toe and controlling the prismatic, an artificial prismatic joint around the base, but we're doing it through the underactuated joint. That's what makes it different from standard Jacobian-based control, is we're going through the underactuated joint, and that allows us to make little dog do things like jump up on a big rock, for instance. This is slow motion again.
Music.
I don't know what music sounds like. All right, so that's what we're now running and jumping over these obstacles using this approach, which I think is generally useful for double support gates. Diving for the goal because it's a race. So, machine learning works. I think in particular, it's well suited to solve the most interesting problem out there, which is this under-actuated control problem, right? In particular, I like under-actuated locomoting systems because they're fun to work with. But you can't just do learning. You gotta be willing to take advantage of mechanical design and plant dynamics, and you have to be able to use classical control like that partial feedback linearization idea. Okay, so approximate optimal control solutions can exploit the dynamics of our walking machine. Produce potentially efficient and robust gates. And the perching plane is actually just the tip of the iceberg on this, on a new set of projects we're doing, which is trying to control for fluid dynamics. And I think, in general, designing control policies for fluid systems, at intermediate Reynolds numbers at least, might be easier than completely describing their dynamics. I don't think birds are solving Navier-Stokes. I think learning learning works pretty well for them. Okay, great. So a lot of people went into that, and thank you for your attention. I'll take any questions.
You're able to cheat and make it a planar problem by having two with an axle.
Exactly.
You anticipated my question about how you do it with an airplane. You put a big dihedral
in.
But as soon as you're not in level flight, you're injecting fluid to the sides.
Yes.
How do you handle that?
Well, we let the approximate model. We are absolutely not modeling that. That's just off in our model. So, you know, so we're actually trying to do smoke biz on this right now, and I think the tip horses are going to make that very hard to do. I think we're getting very 3D flow around the wings. So to actually get the flow resolution, I think we're going to make longer wings to try to get rid of it. Or maybe put in some wing tips, winglets or something. But I think you're absolutely right. We are not capturing that in our 2D model. But it's good enough. Yeah.
So for the seeing the rimless wheel, you said that the impacts were completely not like your model.
Yes.
Now, don't you think you could change your mechanical system a little bit to make it like your model?
I'd prefer for you to change it, but so you could absolutely put springs in there.
Or just dampers or sorbent
dampers
or something.
But that's not the model, right? I'm very interested in making the models match reality. That's one path to do it. Having a better model of the stiff leg hitting the ground is another way to do it. I'm game for all of them, but the point is just that these simple models, which we know and love and can say something about analytically, aren't that good. Right? And actually, every walking robot, I think, has much more subtle interactions with the ground than people give them credit for. It's a hard problem.
In airplane, how does wing work? Is that similar in the sense of terrain as a mass
stochastic? That's the way I'm thinking about it. And I think you're exactly right. We're going to build a stochastic model of the environment and then try to do the stochastic optimization. Exactly, and the experimentally how we're going to get it is before we take it outside, we're actually putting building jets into the motion capture lab, so we have known disturbances, right? I love the motion capture; it's an enabler. But you're absolutely right. That's where we want to go, is to do it despite gusts. And actually, even ambient wind is tough. I mean, if we've got a perch out here, if we've got a wind, we're going to have vortices coming off that perch right where we want to land, right? I mean, there's persistent flow structures that are going to be tough. In the purest form, I think that gusts of wind and those flow structures are things that we can exploit, but they're certainly going to make the problem harder. Yeah,
there's a mismatch between your stochastic metastability ideas and your essentially deterministic design and control systems. Wouldn't it make more sense to use, for example, the cost to get to a goal or the cost to go some amount of time as your, in some sense, stability measure? Rather than talking about stochasticity, which isn't really there?
I think the stochasticity is there, but my...
Well, there might be stochasticity there, but probably not what you're using to do the metastability.
Well, okay, so the first thing is we are actually optimizing exactly the amount of time you walk before you fall down, subject to some constraints that you have to walk forward. We're just doing the expected mean first position. That's what we're optimizing. So that is exactly what we're doing.
In your simulations, they're essentially deterministic systems, aren't they?
Okay. So
so it'll walk forever.
It will walk forever on if the terrain moves. Yeah. So
even the airplane is, I would suspect, fairly repeatable. Unless you start turning random fans on in your lab.
Yeah. It's not as repeatable as you think, actually. There's very small scale events do change things. But so to answer your question, so there's two ways that we do the same optimization for the time of speed. So we either take a known terrain and like walk around on top of that terrain forever and optimize the heck out of that one. Or we pull the terrain out of distribution, solve the stochastic control problem so that it works. We put it on a different terrain that has roughly the same policy. Right? So you can certainly, for a particular terrain, solve for an optimal thing. It should be better because it can overfit on that terrain. The more interesting problem is to do it for some class of terrains and maximize your expected performance. Right? And on the plane, we are so far getting away with a deterministic model of the dynamics. But we're doing feedback control to compensate for those stochastic. If you just do an open loop control, it's not as repeatable as you'd like to think.
So for the policies that you're making for the Compass State Walker or the knee walker on rough terrain, what's the policy get to observe?
So in the Compass State, it's the entire state of the system. The nice thing about quant frame maps is you drop one state. It drops a dimension of one because you're only looking at it through a hyperplane. So for the compass gate, it's the position you are on the terrain, the angle of the first joint, the angle of the second joint, the velocities minus one.
Okay. So, but there's no question of sort of sensing impacts explicitly as impacts. You only observe them through their effects.
I assume it's fully observable.
Okay.
Yep. So and then we'll put motion capture into the loop for the physical thing. We're just starting that.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
When you're making your temporary changes in the morning, you said it can take like 10-20 minutes to finish. Is it because you have to wait a long time to see the effect of your temporary change, or is it?
Good question. Both. So you know, there's actually a big 700 megahertz computer in the belly of that thing, which is way more than needed for it. The learning algorithms are not computationally limited to one. The policy creator algorithms, they're data limited. So it's basically, the game is how many footsteps can you take to get from the real system for two reasons. One, because you want to explore different parts of your state space, and two, because there's a long-term dynamics. So this completely online infinite horizon learning has to trade off those things. You're simultaneously exploring state space, watching for the, you're keeping an eligibility trace for to remember what you did in the recent past, and you have to balance those. So it's both. You know, and so when you walk onto a different terrain, that's one of the reasons why it takes multiple steps to figure it out.
How many steps before you can really tell if it's
yeah, surprised. So you know, something I didn't really predict. It makes sense in retrospect. You know, if you sort of found your way to the end of a bowl, you found yourself at a minimum of some optimization function, and somebody moves the optimization function a little bit, it's really fast to track it. So it's really a step or two, and it looks like it gets it. And there's large changes in the control parameters, but because of that sort of smooth change in the cost function, it works really quickly, surprisingly quickly. Yeah.
How do you take the base functions and over different runs do you converge to the same set of parameters at the end?
Very good question. It's a barycentric mesh over state space. It's not overlapping tiles. It's just an interpolated mesh. And the exact sort of, you know, it's fairly coarse mesh. It's more coarse than you might expect. Mesh, the exact numbers are in the document. And then the second question is, do you converge to the same policy on different trials? We try to study that, and yes, the return map comes out to almost exactly the same thing on every time, but the policy parameters are actually fairly different. The cost function, the cost to go function, converges to almost the same thing every time. There seems to be some redundancy in the actual cost parameters, but it's also hard to tell because we never really, you know, to really converge, you have to turn down the learning rate, and you know, so we could have just been bouncing around. It's hard to tell scale wise. Can't say crystal clear that we always found the same one, but it had that feel. We did, yeah. I think there is. We can build that model. There is a steady state. The thing is, it edges this little bit, and suddenly I can't integrate the equations of motion anymore. So our analytic tools break down when we start studying numerically. Numerically, we know there's the same limit cycle and everything like that. It's just, you know, just that little change that I can't integrate the equations of motion anymore. We build them up. I mean, it makes it a fundamental change. If you bounce, then you have an extra, you have an aerial phase as well as this nice stance phase, so that it just gets to be a more complicated system. But you can build that model, certainly.
Well, let's thank the speaker.